A gas leak sparks new outrage over the Eureka Garden Complex. Nikolai Vidi denies special treatment for kids at the new Grasp Academy. And could Medicaid expansion in Florida go to the voters next year? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. And now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Then later, how Baptist Health is helping local seniors age in place. Plus, we've got details on this weekend's big tree giveaway in Riverside. And the Amelia Musical Playhouse, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for the weekly roundtable here today. Tanya Weathersby of the Florida Times Union. Tanya, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics with us.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT analyst, John Burr.
Thank you for being here.
Great to see all of you and plenty of news from the week to discuss, from school controversies to a local push to get Medicaid expansion on the 2016 ballot in Florida next year and more. But first this morning, another gas leak overnight at the troubled Eureka Garden Complex has led to city intervention and a gas cutoff this morning for the 400 apartments there. The city fire marshal found the leak at the Westside Complex yesterday, so the gas company shut everything off. That leaves residents without warm water, heat, or the ability to cook food. Mayor Lenny Curry this morning saying he's angry, heartbroken, demanding the situation be fixed. We begin the roundtable with a look at this situation, which just seems to be dragging on and on. Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Tanya Weathersby, Mayor Curry saying the Reverend Richard Hamlet, president of the owner of the complex, Global Ministries, must be held accountable, even if Congress needs to intervene. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if Congress needs to intervene, but I think that we have enough tools at our disposal to make the Reverend Richard Hamlet be responsible for what's happening. I think that it's admirable, a lot of what the mayor has done to try to call attention to this problem. But the thing that I would that kind of causes some concern is that this could become kind of a political football, so to speak, in terms of what the federal government is or isn't doing and that sort of thing. It could very easily become that. But yes, those problems at Eureka Garden are very real. They've gone on for quite a while, and what's happening over there is really deplorable. But the Reverend Richard Hamlet could be held accountable without Congress intervening.
John Burr.
You know, when Reverend Hamlet was here a couple of weeks ago, there was a feeling, I listened to your show, and there's a feeling among the listeners that what he was saying, his reassurances about how the place was going to get fixed up and they were going to put millions of dollars into it, there was a, you know, skepticism toward that, I think. And, you know, how he reacts to this this problem right here, which is an immediate, serious problem, will go a long way toward, you know, defining, you know, what's going to happen in the future. I think if something is done and done like right now, then, you know, maybe this situation can be salvaged. But if this just drags on for a few days, I'm afraid the city and HUD, which also is investigating Eureka Gardens, is going to really come down hard on them.
HUD actually passed inspection on this complex, A.G. Gankarski, before a local activist, Denise Hunt, demanded that more be done. And the owner of this property owns similar properties throughout the Southeast that have also received harsh media scrutiny for similar problems.
Right. And, you know, their modus operandi is to buy these blighted properties and to promise repairs that don't actually happen. You know, the Curry administration is calling them on it. But when we look at this current incident, you've got a really good case for reckless endangerment. You know, like somebody said, if, you know, somebody had flicked a cigarette, it could have resulted in a fire and deaths. And this is something that is a foreseeable risk for the people who manage that complex, especially in light of the scrutiny. You know, I think Mayor Curry needs to be down at that complex, overseeing what's happening, making sure things are done right. And I think the state attorney may need to step in because, you know, at some point this is criminal negligence. And if this were happening in, you know, something that wasn't Section 8 housing, what would people be saying?
James tweets the show, I believe the word that Mayor Curry used was pissed.
Ooh.
Tanya Weathersby, I believe that's the first time a sitting mayor of the city has probably used that word publicly. Your thoughts about that?
I'm a journalist, and I believe in honesty, and this is how he honestly felt. I guess that's how he felt.
Sure.
That's how he felt. That's how he felt.
And I think that does reflect the feelings of a great many people when they realized, John, that through many mayoral administrations, let's be fair, this has been an issue, and folks have turned a blind eye for a very long time, and not just in Eureka Garden. All over the North and West Side, you've got folks living in deplorable conditions. And Tanya, you write about that with regularity.
Yes. That's another thing, too. I mean, it's Eureka Gardens right now. But Global Ministries, as I understand it, also manages Washington Heights.
Mm-hmm.
It also manages Cleveland Arms. There's all kinds of problems over in those areas as well. And it's just gone on for a long time. And unfortunately, a lot of the people that have been voiceless for so long, until nobody's really paid attention to it until now, with some of the work of activists such as Denise Hunt and other people who've helped them to find a voice and to speak out about these problems. And, you know, in all honesty, it's very good that it's getting some real attention at this point. Because like AJ said, just to pivot off what AJ and John said, it's almost to the point of criminal, you know, negligence at this point. Of that gas leak is serious business. That's real serious. So, you know, it depends on if the reverend can keep his word, that's fine. But, you know, it's more, he has to, because it's becoming a real situation because people can die.
His company, his nonprofit, could lose control of the property. Yeah. I mean, that's what the HUD investigation is about, that's ongoing. And, you know, if that happens, then all of the other properties that his ministry controls are going to come under question and scrutiny. And you know, it could be, you know, a very bad time for the Reverend and his enterprises.
Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Hector in San Jose is with us. Hello, Hector. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I've been living in Jacksonville for about 10 years. I moved here from Dominican Republic. And from what I understand, talking to some people, this issue is not new. It's been going on since those apartment complexes were there. And what's confusing to me is how come the HUD person is not being fired by the federal government? The congresswoman that's screaming very loud, why is people protesting against her? Because she's been the congressperson here forever, from what I understand, and she's known about this. Only person who was standing up for them is Lenny Curry at this time, and the current mayor, he knew about this, and a mayor before him knew about this, and a mayor before that person knew about this. So it seems very strange to me, almost criminal, that these people, they're letting people come in and exploit the poor here in this community, and it's going on and on and on, and all they're doing is giving lip service back to the mayor when the HUD person should be fired, the congresswoman should step down. The media actually should be ashamed of itself for not putting the spotlight on these cockroaches, these cucarachas, who are doing this to the population here. This is insane.
Well, thanks, Hector. I appreciate your call. Let me just, though, point out that, as I mentioned a moment ago, Tanya, sitting right here, has written about these issues for a long time. Tanya, you have tried for many years to shine a light on this. And you are a member of the media.
Yes, I am. I've written about it in my Thursday Times Union column. That's basically what my column deals about, is poverty, inequality, the fact that a lot of people are living in these job deserts. The two complexes where you have all these problems that are also owned by Global Ministries, Washington Heights and Cleveland Arms, and 32209, and you'll hear me talk about that a lot. 32209 is the worst zip code in the state for a job. Jobs mean empowerment, that people can have a voice and lift themselves out of these situations. So I've been talking about that for a long time. It's just a lot of people have not been paying attention.
What about the caller's other points, AG?
Well, you know, that's kind of reductionist because, you know, a few months back at least, Denise Lee and Warren Jones basically brought it up that, you know, we need to issue a resolution that HUD no longer fund these complexes, you know, Eureka Gardens, Washington Heights, Cleveland Arms, because of these issues. I mean, they have been on the radar. It's just getting action. And of course, you know, the fact that Mayor Brown's administration had, you know, facilitated $34 million of low interest loans to this operation, you know, raises questions there of what did the mayor know and when did he know it. But, you know, that said, Mayor Curry has called attention to it, but, you know, he's got to do more than call attention to it. He's got to find a solution because you've got three of these complexes that are essentially the same. They are isolated from jobs. They're isolated from meaningful transit. And you've got a lot of people, you know, who are just struggling, you know, trying to get through there, you know, who have their basic needs neglected.
And let's go to Jane on the west side. Jane, I know you have to go soon, but go ahead quickly.
Well, thank you. I've been hoping for an opportunity such as your program. I'm an insurance broker, and for I'm going to say hypothetically, near 20 years ago, the management company that handled not only Eureka but the other two apartment complexes that have been mentioned was superlative, whereas the company had 250 employees, and when we had employee meetings, we had them at the Eureka Garden Clubhouse. You could have eaten off that clubhouse floor. I mean, the place was managed to that degree. Then there was an issue about putting lights up in Eureka Gardens, and the management company at that time was not interested in assisting in that. And that's when Pizza Hut decided that they weren't going to deliver anymore, and a lot of other people were not interested in helping in that area for fear. And that's where I left it. But somebody took a perfectly good place, and I could only speak for Eureka because I traveled the other apartment complexes, but not as often. So I don't have the recall that I have with Eureka because that was the focal point of all the employees' meetings. It's just a tragedy that something, I'm sure, just through neglect wasn't maintained.
Sure. Thanks for that, Jane. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. John.
You know, I see a lot of similarities here between this situation and the VA. I mean, the VA is also a federal program that's been scandalized for decades. And we had a latest blow up 6-8 months ago over the VA here in Jacksonville and nationally, you know, and what's been done, you know, there's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of, oh, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. Somebody got fired, you know, but unfortunately, we could be sitting here in 5 years and get a call from a justifiably outraged person saying, you know, why hasn't anybody cleaned up the VA? This has been going on for years. You know, this. So, you know, we've got a problem here with bureaucracies that aren't responsive. Yeah. And, you know, also people have to get involved. And thankfully, they have with Eureka Gardens. Yeah. They've gotten involved.
Yeah, people are demanding that those who are responsible be held accountable.
That's right.
And as we take your calls on these issues, we want you to give us a call at 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, Duval Superintendent Nicolae Vitti is denying allegations that the city's new GRASP Academy, a school for kids with dyslexia and other learning disabilities, receives any special treatment. Both Vitti and his two sons are dyslexic, and the district has budgeted a higher than average amount for kids per student at this school. But the formula isn't so cut and dried, Tanya, as the Times Union reports, because these are students with learning disabilities. This is something that the superintendent is dealing with on top of a host of other issues dealing with public education right now.
Yes, I was reading the story about this, and quite frankly, I don't really, except for what the University of North Florida professor said about the possibility that a lot of students who may need the services may not be able to get access to them, I have a hard time seeing what the real issue is here. I mean, the superintendent is dyslexic. His children are dyslexic. We know from research that most of the kids who have reading problems is usually due to dyslexia. And this is the first academy we have like this. So this is kind of like a, you know, so to speak, a maiden voyage because it's just starting out. I think people should give it a chance for it to work because it just opened. And let's see what happens. The only real issue is that some students who may need access to it may not be able to get access to it under the current formula. But other than that, I don't see it as an issue of, like some people seem to be pointing it as favoritism. I'm just not really seeing that.
AG.
Well, you know, VD has actually talked about, you know, extending the principles of reading education for dyslexic kids to the entire school population because there are so many kids who are dyslexic to some degree. One of the issues, though, is this, that Nikolai Vidi does not have much help when it comes to image construction. Time and time again, he's pilloried in the press. Time and time again, you know, he has no effective answer. And, you know, what does that come down to? It comes down to, on some level, his communication people over the last few years who have not done him any favors, who have not gotten out in front of these things and messaged them. And, you know, Nikolai Vidi, in some sense, is the most vilified person in Jacksonville politics, and you have to ask yourself why.
I think it has to do in part with what you're saying and also in part due to the fact that, as we discussed in a taping last night of our new program, Community Thread, a television show and radio stories that will deal with these issues of public education, you're looking at the changes Dr. Vidi is trying to bring to the school system. You're looking at the controversy over Common Core and standardized testing. You're looking at teacher frustration over new curriculum. You're looking at reduced funding for education and the growth of charter schools. There are just a host of controversies around around public education issues, and he's at the center of all of that. John Burr.
He's at the center of it locally, but he has not caused any of these situations. They've all been brought to him or to us. By the state government or the federal government, in the case of Common Cause. You know, school superintendents of big city school districts, unfortunately, are punching bags. And I forget the exact statistic, but I think, you know, the average they last is 2 to 3 years in their job. And, you know, you don't see the superintendent of St. John's County getting raked over the coals like Mr. Vidi is. And I have to agree, I think it's kind of unfair.
Tanya.
What John said, big cities superintendents, it's a real struggle because unlike superintendents of smaller areas where you probably have suburbs where people are more affluent, you get the same test results. They come from, you know, more affluent backgrounds. You get a variety of students from various ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds, some high poverty areas, and everybody expects for these superintendents to turn everything around overnight when it's a question not just of resources in the school system, but jobs and resources in the community so that parents can give their kids the right kind of direction and expose them to the things that are going to make them successful in school. So, yes, they have a real struggle.
And there is that struggle, and as you're pointing out, AG, Nikolai Vidi is a guy who, let's face it, doesn't suffer fools.
No.
Let's just come right out with it. He is smart. He is direct. He is to the point. That style, that demeanor, doesn't always go over well with some folks.
And he's also thin-skinned. I mean, you see it time and time again when Corrine Brown went to the school, a redistricting workshop. You know, he didn't handle that well. He, you know, was called out by school board members for inappropriate communication style. Apparently, he's been working with a coach for that. I mean, these are not good factors. And, you know, honestly, you know, VD's job is not as secure as it may look because, you know, what if Jason Fisher's off that board and, you know, it takes 4 votes to remove him? You know, Jason Fisher is a big supporter of his, so is Scott Shine, but, you know, everybody else could move on that issue, theoretically. And if somebody comes in to replace Fisher, who is less amenable to VD's changes, then his job security could be in question.
But it's an easy target. Any superintendent of a large district, urban district.
If you're getting paid Duval, $300,000 a year, you better get your image construction in order.
We taped a program last night with Dr. Vidi, the chairwoman of the school board, the head of the teachers union, a studio audience, and it was a very collegial conversation with the superintendent and others. And I just want to put in the plug for our Community Thread. It's our old First Coast Forum, now reborn as Community Thread, a television show and ongoing radio stories. This new program, Nikolai Vidi and the Future of Duval Schools, will premiere Thursday, November 19th at 8 p.m. on WJCT Public Television, with an encore date Sunday, November 22nd at 1 p.m. We also want to let everyone know you can access this online or through our new app, our new WJCT app. So please do watch it. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Give us a call with your thoughts on the top stories of the week. Right now, we want you to call us about the city's HRO. The Jacksonville Coalition for Equality, now touting the support of local faith leaders in its push for an updated human rights ordinance that covers LGBT citizens. One local pastor who has very publicly switched his stance is the Reverend R.L. Gundy of Jacksonville's Mount Sinai Baptist Church, an AME church. Gundy, of course, opposed the ordinance as recently as 2012, Tanya Weathersby. He's changed his mind. What do you think?
Well, I think it's great that he changed his mind. I couldn't make much of his answer as to why he changed his mind, but it's good to see that Gundy, who has carried quite a bit of weight in the civil rights community here, has come forward and signed on to this. I don't know what exactly gave him his moment or what was the defining moment for him. He hasn't really expressed it except to say that he thought that the movement of people who were trying to get him involved didn't reach the grassroots enough. So I don't know what that really means, but it's good to see he came on board.
AG.
Well, you know, Florida Politics, we reported on it in the spring that the Human Rights Campaign was on the ground talking to African-American preachers. We're seeing the fruit of those efforts. You know, R.L. Gundy's significant because he was so high profile 3 years ago against, and now he's a voice for. You can expect to see others following in that wake. And the real unanswered question, though, is exactly what happened in those conversations between the Human Rights Campaign and African-American pastors.
And you quoted the Rabbi Joshua Leaf, AG, when he said at this meeting, "It's not a question of whether it's right or wrong to be gay. It's a question of whether or not it's right to discriminate." Gundy saying, "We want this passed so all people can be treated like human beings." John Burr.
I find it ironic that as much as Jacksonville has changed over the years, that, you know, some things never change. And that is that, you know, we're going to get an HRO ordinance expansion now because, you know, the religious community wants it or is behind it. That kind of shows you the power of the religious community in Jacksonville. And we all knew that, former Mayor Brown did not support the HRO because the religious community and in particular his backers in the religious community did not want it, including Reverend Gundy. So, you know, hey, there's a lot of decisions being made in Jacksonville from the pulpit. That's all I have to say.
Well, I don't know if those are decisions are actually made, because if you look at it, what happened in Houston, you know, a prolonged campaign that basically reduced the whole HERO ordinance, Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, to, you know, the issue of transgender people using bathrooms. And, you know, that's the thing that happens with these campaigns is, you know, they have very viral, you know, very vitriolic, very effective campaigns that can swing people.
And I think the Coalition for Equality people want to neutralize any prospect of that happening here.
They're going to have to get out in front of
get out in front
and
of
actually
that now.
Counter message to people who are going to be, you know, attacking
Tanya.
Them.
And it'll be interesting to see with more ministers, and if the campaign manages to get more ministers to come on board, what the counter reaction is going to be. I mean, like AJ says, what if they, you know, reduce it to something like the, you know, people using the same bathrooms? I mean, the opposition, we don't know how virulent it is, but it could, but something like that could happen. So they still have to stay out in front, as you said, even if they get more supporters.
Something else that could happen next year, you might get the chance to vote on Medicaid expansion. A local businessman is behind the statewide petition drive to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot next year that would support Medicaid expansion in Florida. Mincy Pollock, who ran for city council, lost to Tommy Hazzuri, has now formed the Political Action Committee Florida Health Solutions. Florida is one of 20 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. That leaves about a million residents ineligible to buy insurance. Had Florida expanded Medicaid, the state would have received $51 billion over the next decade. Pollack aims to get about 683,000 signatures on this petition to get this amendment on the ballot in 2016. This could put it to an up or down vote. John Burr, what do you think of this strategy?
Well, it's probably the only strategy that has a chance of working. We had the state legislature really came almost to a standstill this year over this issue. But the Senate is ready to go for Medicaid expansion. I don't think the House is going to move on that.
They are not moving on it. Corrine Brown at the news conference on this Tuesday, AG, says it's inhumane to deny the uninsured access to quality health care, pushing this petition effort.
Yeah. And, she's been on this for a while. I mean, it's basically her against Rick Scott on this. She basically said at a press conference that $14 billion has been forfeited back to the federal government because of our, Medicaid policy. I talked to Rick Scott on Veterans Day and got his take on it, and he still thinks, well, if the federal government, wants the program, they need to fully fund it.
That's the argument against it, Tanya, is that what if the states cannot afford it once the federal government stops paying 100%?
Well, I think a lot of research has been done showing that the states will be able to afford it by the time that they stop paying. I mean, I can't recall it right offhand, but I think some stuff has been done to show that the states will be able to afford it. And it's so far in the future, actually, until the states can make plans to be able to pay for it. So whenever the Fed stop paying for it, that's just something the states would have to be proactive on, as they are on other issues and other things. So that's kind of a cop-out. But getting back to the original question, I think that it could, on the ballot, that's probably the only way they're going to be able to do it. And it's been done with stuff like class sizes and everything. So, be interesting to see.
Well, we did pass a class size amendment, but as we've seen, that doesn't always get enforced. That doesn't always go through. I mean, you can vote something through, and it doesn't mean that it actually happens.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean.
So, but, the thing is, I think the class size amendment is a good example of the public feeling the state legislature is not responsive to a critical need, in that case being, public education, and taking the situation in their own hands and demanding this. And we'll see, if this petition thing goes, we'll see if that works for the Medicaid expansion, too.
And the petition, creator is Mincy Pollack. As I mentioned, he did run last year for the city council. He didn't make it. But speaking of the city council, they've decided not to give themselves a raise, at least for now, holding off on increasing their own salary increase after some members argued the city's rank and file workers should get an increase before they do. The guy that beat Pollack, Councilman Tommy Hazzuri, drew loud applause when he said that he just doesn't think it's right, AG, to give himself a raise yet.
Profile and courage on Tuesday night with the council that basically pushed it through finance, had public notice meetings about it. You had Crescent Benny, Greg Anderson, Matt Schellenberg, who sponsored a bill, advocating it. And it was smooth sailing up until they got into the council floor, and there are, 40 cops standing in the back with their arms crossed, looking like security of the first world. And, it went very quickly into debate. You had dissent. You had Danny Becton saying, well, we were voting for, 2%, and this is actually pushing it higher to $46,000 a year. And you had other dissent, and they pushed it back to finance, which I presume will be in finance Monday. And we'll see where the debate goes from there. But it seems like something they're going to try to backdoor in again. But the police officers are not happy. They're not happy with the narrative against the police and fire pension fund. They feel like they're being dissed. They haven't gotten a real pay raise in about 5 years. And, this is a narrative that is going to be developing over the first term of Lenny Curry.
Well, it has been a busy news week, but finally we have a look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida, the drunken edition. Only in Florida do drunk guys try to scale Mexican pyramids at Disney World's Epcot Food and Wine Festival. Yeah. This was captured on video. A guy climbed the pyramid that is strictly prohibited, but the drunken man successfully scaled it and then climbed down a different side to avoid getting caught. Of course, this did take place at the Food and Wine Festival. He probably had a little wine.
Right, he was seeing if grain was in it. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yes. Some presidential candidates do say these stored grains. That's a separate issue.
There's some grain alcohol.
The grain alcohol, maybe, yes. Yeah. This runs through November 16th, the Food and Wine Festival. Now, only in Florida is a police officer too drunk to collect an award he won from the group
drank.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Pinellas County Sheriff Officer Michael Zelliga was at a two-day DUI law enforcement training seminar in Fort Lauderdale, hosted by MAD, a group that tends to frown on excessive drinking. Seliga was there to get a prize for making more than 100 DUI arrests. But during the event, he was spotted in the hotel halls, stumbling around in nothing but his underwear. He also skipped out on the first training session to play a round of cornhole in the hotel courtyard. It's alleged that Seliga was incapacitated when he drove himself to the event. But Seliga, who's clearly learned a few things from the dozens of people he's arrested for DUI, insists he only had one or two drinks.
That's admirable.
Takes a drunk to know a drunk. Right?
Speaking of drunk driving, only in Florida do drunk drivers crash into the mailbox of singer Rod Stewart's home.
Do you think I'm swerving?
Now, this happened in Palm Beach. Police there say 37-year-old Michael Lutz was weaving on the road when he was pulled over. Lutz hit Stewart's mailbox as he pulled over, causing hundreds of dollars in damage. Mm. As Rod might say, in fact, he has said, the first cut is the deepest. Nothing. Wow. Lutz faces a DUI charge.
It's like that Rod Stewart song, Intoxication.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much, Tanya Weathersby, John Burr, and A.G. Gankarski. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Later, we'll spotlight the Amelia Musical Playhouse, tell you about Saturday's Big Tree giveaway. But up next, how Baptist Health is helping local seniors age in place. Stay with us.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play. Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools, including school zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites you to tune in for a conversation hosted by Melissa Ross with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti and community stakeholders about the direction of our schools. Community Thread, coming November 19th at 8 p.m. on WJCT Public Television.
On the next Jazz Night in America, trumpeter Marquise Hill comes home to Chicago.
Motown, the Spinners, the Isley Brothers, Marvin Gaye, the OJs, so the types of music that I was exposed to, they're just kind of in me, you know.
And we catch up with some people and places that shaped him.
Marquise had a big fat tone, like Louis Armstrong.
Marquise Hill, Black Tet. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, November is National Family Caregivers Month. Anyone who's been in the position of caring for an older loved one knows its challenges. With that in mind, Baptist Health is holding a conference next weekend. It's called There's No Place Like Home, Aging in Place, with some great tips on how to best interact with older adults. that are aging and want to age in place. Here with a preview, we welcome geriatrician Rafael Balbino, MD. He's with Baptist Health's Age Well Center for Senior Health. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
This is a topic of interest to so many people, older adults that want to live independently and want to age in place. What's going to be happening next Saturday?
So we are very fortunate here in Jacksonville to have the presence of Tipa Snow. She has been a leading dementia educator, not only for the health profession, but also for family members as well. And I've personally actually learned a lot from her, even in my geriatric training, and often will think of some of her illustrations in her materials to explain to the families what it is to live with dementia. Because a lot of people have questions about it, but they have family members who are having problems with their memory, and they don't necessarily understand what it is from the inside. And she really is an excellent communicator at explaining those things.
And there are some important differences between forgetfulness and memory loss and actual dementia that you want to differentiate, right?
That's correct. And even yesterday, I had a patient that we went through all of the continuum of memory loss that can happen. We know that there's some basic things that can happen with all of us in terms of just aging that is very different than dementia. And the main difference is an inability to completely care for oneself that happens with dementia. And there's a decline. There has to be a progression about it. Normal aging will just cause problems with word finding difficulties. There's a decrease in the speed of processing of information, et cetera, but not to the point that you see with dementia. Absolutely.
Now, you'll also discuss some of the facts and myths around aging well.
Yeah, that part is incumbent on me. So I'll also have a talk with the community as well. And we're going to discuss some myths that are still very, very pervasive in the culture about aging, and trying to differentiate that between some facts that we know, and kind of put those things in perspective. We're also going to have some time for a Q&A session as well.
This is such an important topic because for so many seniors, living at home and staying at home and staying active has become so important.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And even, you know, driving is also kind of a symbol of that. We have a lot of people who come in and the family's concerned about their driving. And so we want to take those questions very seriously because it's a concern that we have for the patient's own safety and the community beyond. And so we actually do evaluations for driving, appropriateness as well in our clinic.
And there's important information for the caregiver. This is a caregiver's conference. The stress caregivers go through is also significant.
That's right. We will have a part after me on that Saturday by Dr. Rothman, who's our full-time psychologist. She'll actually be talking about all the stress that caregivers go through and how they can care for themselves as well. And, you know, this is part of what we do at Age Well Center, the clinic that we have in downtown Baptist, because we have from the social work team, from the psychologists, our psychiatrist, and even pastoral care, we're always there to try and learn about what the caregivers are going through and helping them go on this journey that sometimes is very, very burdensome.
It sure can be. And so the Third Annual Caregivers Conference coming up next Saturday, November 21st, on the UNF campus is such an important event with one of America's leading dementia educators, Tipa Snow, on hand. Age Well, the Center for Senior Health at Baptist Health, doing this event. Go to www.baptist/agewell to register and find out more. And Doctor, thanks so much for joining us with this important information.
My pleasure.
He's Dr. Rafael Balbino, MD, a geriatrician with Baptist Health's Age Well Center for Senior Health. Again, that conference is next Saturday, the 21st, on the UNF campus. Still to come, the Amelia Musical Playhouse, but up next, find out where you can get a free tree for your yard. This weekend, we'll tell you about Saturday's big tree giveaway. That's next.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union present the 13th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used men, women, and children's sweaters, jackets, socks, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and Two Men in a Truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Join us Sunday nights at 7 on 89.9 for classic old-time radio with music, mystery, comedy, and news. It's all at 7 o'clock Sunday nights, only on 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, you need to get up bright and early tomorrow morning if you're in the market for some free trees. Yeah, you heard that right. Greenscape of Jacksonville is partnering with CSX in the Trees for Tracks tree giveaway. Now you can choose from a bald cypress, a red maple, or a sweet gum tree to plant at your home or out in the community. Just one tree per car. And the big giveaway kicks off at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning on Post Street in Riverside by the Cummer Museum. Anna Dooley, Executive Director of Greenscape of Jacks, and John Kitchens, Corporate Citizenship Director with CSX, join us now to tell us all about this partnership. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So exciting. As our media roundtable was leaving, they said, well, free trees. What's this all about? Everybody's interested in this one, Anna. You're going to give away trees. How about that?
We are going to give away trees, thanks to CSX. And, you know, I'm just excited. Everybody wants trees. And so now the message is really out there. People know how important trees are to our community.
Jacksonville is beloved for its tree canopy. I think that's very fair to say.
Absolutely. And, you know, Greenscape has a 40-year history of planting trees and providing education about them and advocating for them. And so when we have a wonderful corporate sponsor such as CSX who shares that passion, it's a real blessing.
Now, the Trees for Tracks giveaway, of course, John, is in partnership with CSX. This is a national program, correct?
It is. We provide trees in 23 states in which the company operates. And being that this is our headquarters location, Jacksonville gets its fair percentage of that program proceeds.
And so the idea is to provide at least one tree for every mile of your railroad track?
That's correct. Initially, the program was a five-year goal to plant one tree for each of our 21,000 miles of rail service. The program concluded, and people were so happy to have the opportunity that we decided to do it again. So we're working on two trees for every one of our 21,000 miles.
Now, CSX and Greenscape, since you've teamed up, you have increased the tree canopy in the city by more than 1,200 trees, is that right?
That's correct. Thanks to Anna's good record keeping, she went back and found that out for us. And then tomorrow we'll be adding 800 trees to that number.
Let's explain to everyone listening to the sound of your voice, Anna, what they need to do to get their hands on a free tree. First thing tomorrow,
get up, get happy, put on some clothes that you're going to want to plant a tree in, and then drive on over. Post Street runs right between the Garden Club building and the side of the Cummer Museum. You'll be able to pull through there. We will have experts that will show you pictures of the three species we're offering. You can learn about them. You'll drive right through, and the good CSX volunteers will put a tree in your car, and you can go home and get a shovel.
It's like going through a fast food drive-thru. You don't get out of your car.
You don't
you
have
just
to
drive,
get out of your
you
car.
You drive through, and you drive out.
What could be better?
Wow. And CSX on hand as well, John?
Yeah, we'll be there with more than 50 volunteers, trying to make sure that everybody is getting their trees safely and securely and gets out of there and is able to get home and plant those trees.
And if you don't know how to plant a tree, you guys will have some tips.
I'm going to have a handout for everybody with planting instructions. And also, this will be part of the Jack's Digs Trees new tree campaign. So CSX is out there setting an example for other corporate groups that to challenge them to put more trees out in the community. But the fun part of this, it's like the ice bucket challenge. We want to see people hashtag Jack's Digs Trees posting photos or videos of themselves, their families, or whoever planting trees and then challenging other people to do the same.
Excellent. But John, we do need to remind people once again, just one tree per car, sadly. But one free tree is still pretty good.
Yeah, we're hoping that we get plenty of people coming out and taking advantage of it. And right now we're looking at one tree per car.
All right. And again, it is the Trees for Tracks tree giveaway, bright and early, 9 a.m. tomorrow on Post Street between the Cummer Museum and the Garden Club in Riverside. Get out there and get your free tree. Anna Dooley with Greenscape, John Kitchens at CSX here to share it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In a moment, how the Amelia Musical Playhouse took an old tavern and became a beacon for live theater.
Heard about poached rhino horns and elephant ivory, but what about Venus flytraps? I'm John Dankosky. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the trade in illegal and endangered plants. Plus, how can we learn to make better decisions from slime molds? That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Well, finally, this hour, we turn the spotlight on a growing theater group up in Fernandina Beach. A couple of years ago, a couple there, Jill and Greg Dillingham, bought the old Midtown Bar and decided to turn it into a playhouse. Since that time, they've staged dozens of productions. Next month, the Amelia Musical Playhouse will debut Charlotte's Web the Musical, adapted from the original classic tale by E.B. White. Jill Dillingham, co-owner of the Amelia Musical Playhouse, and volunteer actor and director Mary Williams join the show now with more. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning,
Melissa.
Good morning.
So you took an old bar and said, let's make this into a theater?
It had sat there empty for about 7 years, and we were looking for a rehearsal space. Mary and I had started a singing group. And we were looking for a rehearsal space, and we found this place. And
is it on Center Street in Fernandina Beach?
No, it's actually on Fast Food Row. It's right right off of 8th Street.
And so what was it like to take that property and rehab it and turn it around?
It was an enormous project, but so many people helped us. Hundreds of people went in there and worked and painted and weeded and
Because there's so much enthusiasm for the arts on Amelia Island, isn't there?
It's a very artful community, both performing arts and visual arts. And in fact, there are three community theaters there. But as a volunteer, we came to work with the Dillinghams on both the restoration of the building and in show production because we're my husband and I both enjoy the musical experience so much.
So Charlotte's Web the Musical is going to debut next month. The first show is December 4th, and this is an adaptation of the classic story.
It sticks very close to the original. The dialogue is very close.
And what are the musical numbers like?
They're written by Charles Strauss, who wrote Bye Bye Birdie, the music for Bye Bye Birdie, and Annie. So actually the music is very similar to Annie music, very 20s, 30s kind of flavor. But we're doing it, we have a couple violins and a banjo, so we're doing sort of vaudeville-sounding music with a country twist on it.
And this is a perfect family show at the holidays to take your kids to see.
Absolutely.
And musical theater is a heavy lift. You've got to have good acoustics. You've got to have the right mix of talent. But it's rewarding as well.
It's very rewarding. And Charlotte's Web is just one example of the variety of things that we do as volunteers at this theater. The one that I'm most closely involved with following Charlotte's Web is Night at the Opera in February. And we've got some wonderful singers and classical musicians who come in there and perform. And our audiences dress and love to come to the opera as much as they do a family-friendly show like Charlotte's Web.
So in just 2 years, 9 musical revues, 9 non-musicals, and 11 full-scale musicals along with the student theater group.
12 or 13.
12 or 13 now.
We basically do a musical every other month, right? We have different directors and different rehearsal schedules. Charlotte's Web is coming up. Then we have the community band is doing a holiday concert, but we are in rehearsal for Camelot, which is in January. We have a one-woman show in January, but then auditions for Spamalot are tonight and tomorrow morning.
Oh.
And that'll follow in March. In June, we have My Fair Lady. In August, we have Chicago.
You guys aren't busy at all.
Not at all.
People need to go to your website right now to buy tickets or audition. It's AmeliaMusicalPlayhouse.com.
Yes.
AmeliaMusicalPlayhouse.com. Charlotte's Web, the musical, debuting December 4th. Auditions for Spamalot are this week, with a host of other productions on tap. In just 2 years, this theater has really taken off. So thanks for driving down here to hang out in the studio with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Jill Dillingham is a co-owner of the Amelia Musical Playhouse. Mary Williams is a volunteer actor and director. Again, that website, AmeliaMusicalPlayhouse.com, and that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum running the board all this week. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a program. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on The Diane Rehm Show, a look at the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.